for some reason I thought it'd be nice to have it in the shrine room, as it's Buddha Day, and so welcome everybody, and thank you for coming. I think the best way, really, of marking Buddha Day is just to come together as a Sangha. So it's very nice to see so many people here, and particular thanks for those of you that spent the day here meditating. So I'm going to give what I suspect will be a fairly short talk, hopefully, and then we'll go practically straight into a puja, which Tara Kurinda is going to lead, to mark Buddha Day. Okay. So I spent the day meditating with some of you, and as is often the way, when I'm meditating slightly, obviously I'm slightly thinking about, oh no, sending all that. It's going to happen, isn't it, all the way, every time. I'll wait for this one. This is not good for the recording, is it? You're just going to get the...
Start again. When it come down, just start.
I'm not going to start again.
A meaningful silence.
A meaningful silence, yeah. Hello. Yes, so as I said, I was sitting here today meditating with some of you, and one particular poem kept sort of insisting itself on me, so I thought I would start with this poem and see what unfolds from that, really. And it's one that some of you will no doubt know, because it's a poem I quite often use. I particularly tend to use it quite a lot at the beginning of retreats, and particularly in the winter, but it's not winter now. Although it could be, couldn't it? Yeah, it's nearly winter. And it's a David White one, and it's called Faith. I want to speak about faith, about the way the moon rises over cold snow, night after night, faithful even as it fades from fullness, slowly becoming at last impossible sliver before the final darkness. But I have no faith myself. I refuse it the smallest entry. Let this then, my small poem, like a new moon, slender and barely open, be the first prayer that opens me to faith. So I think this poem was coming to my mind because I've been thinking, well, what is the significance of the Buddha for us now? And the founder of this particular Buddhist movement, now called the Tri Ratna Community, Buddhist Community, Sangharakshita, he insisted, and he still does insist, I think, and he's always insisted that the defining and central act of a Buddhist is going for refuge. It's this idea of going for refuge. And I'm sure most of you know the three refuges of the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha. So when we, every time, hopefully, we come into a shrine, we remember that by saluting the shrine and paying our respects to those refuges, as it were. And although there's three of them, in a way you could say all of them stem from the central refuge of the Buddha. So I think in order for us to be Buddhist or to practice the teachings of the Buddha, we have to have some sort of faith in the Buddha. Yeah, we have to have some sort of faith. We have to have some sort of opening towards what the Buddha stands for. So I thought I'd like to try and talk a little bit, partially, I'm sure, because it's such a big subject really, but talk a little bit about the Buddha's life in relation to what he shows us, what he offers us, yeah? And why what he offers us might be an encouragement. This word faith, I mean, I don't know how David White's using it in that poem, but this, the word that normally gets translated in Buddhism as faith is shraddha, which is confidence. Probably more like what we'd call confidence. So we're never asked to have faith in the Buddha as some sort of supernatural power. He doesn't represent this. This is quite a distinctive and important feature, I think. The Buddha was a human being. And therefore, even on an archetypal level, he represents a human being. He represents us, as it were. Or at least us in potential. Yeah. And I think it's this more than anything, for me, which makes the Buddha so significant. Yeah, because I believe what the Buddha represents really is a human being who has decided, made a decision, or had an experience that's propelled him or her to try and live from what's deepest in them. Yeah, and I think for me this is what's most significant about the Buddha as an archetype, as a model, as someone we can kind of turn towards. It's an example of a human being who's decided to live their life as deeply as they possibly can. And I think for all of us as human beings, that's kind of the basic challenge that we face in life, the basic decision that we have, whether we're going to do that or whether we're going to live our life in a somewhat superficial way. We're going to sort of go through life as if it's some sort of rehearsal for something else, yeah? And according to Buddhism, our life here now isn't a rehearsal for anything else. It's what we've got. This is our life, yeah? And this seems a very obvious point, but actually it's quite a distinctive point about the Dharma and Buddhism. Most religions, actually, and I personally I wouldn't even call Buddhism a religion, but most faiths kind of defer it off to somewhere else, yeah. Quite often our life on earth, as it were, is simply a sort of staging post to some more glorious life somewhere else. But this isn't, I don't think, what the Buddha was offering us. I think what the Buddha was offering us was the possibility of turning fully into this life, being fully present in this life, and living what we might call a good life. I'm quite interested in this idea of the good life, because some of you will recognize it's a term that we get from our own philosophical tradition, the Western tradition. We find it in the Greek philosophers. We particularly find it in Socrates, this idea of a good life. He famously said, you know, the unexamined life is not worth living. This was one of his best-known maxims, yeah. And there's a lot of similarities between Socrates as a sort of archetypal sage and the Buddha as an archetypal sage. Socrates called himself the midwife. He considers himself a midwife. And he was a midwife in trying to birth people's minds, as it were. And he very often did this by Socratic dialogue, by engaging with people. And it's strikingly similar with what the Buddha did after his enlightenment. Anyway, we might get to that. And I better get on with what I was going to say. Or we're going to be here for a long time. So I wanted to start with, you could start, obviously we could start with the Buddha's birth, but I'm not, or Siddhartha's birth. It's not the Buddha, is it, at this point? Prince Siddhartha's birth. But I wanted to start with the four sights. It seems like a good place to start. So we've got the Buddha as a relatively young man in his 20s, been brought up in relative comfort. Well, according to the legends, he's been brought up in great luxury. We don't really know the truth of this, but he's had a comfortable upbringing, and we presume he's had a good sort of education, whatever that meant in those days. He's supposed to have been educated as a warrior. He's been brought up as a warrior. He's been brought up to take over the kingship or the headship of his clan. And at some point, he has this experience of the four sights, and these four sights are extremely important because they stand not only at the beginning of his, what will become his quest, if you like, they stand also at the beginning of all of ours, yeah. And I'm sure most of you know what the four sights are, but I'll just mention them, just in case there's anybody that doesn't. So they are usually referred to as a sick man, could be a sick woman, an old man or woman, a dead person, and a mendicant, a wandering shramana. And he has the first three, we're told, when he's left his normal environment of the palace, gone into the local town, and he sees these three sights, sometimes on three separate trips out, sometimes seems to be all at once, but it doesn't really matter. So he has these three sights. And so it's these sights, these first three sights, that brings him, who's had a relatively, or not relatively, a very comfortable, we're told rather cosseted upbringing. It's supposed to have first brought him into relationship with suffering. And this is really where Buddhism, or the teachings of Buddhism, begin. Yeah. We find, of course, these four sights become the foundation for what become the Four Noble Truths. Yeah. So the first of these three sights relate to the First Noble Truth, the truth of suffering. And I think this is of pivotal importance to us, because it marks the beginning of a spiritual life, in terms of a Buddhist spiritual life anyway. So I just want to say a few things about what this coming into contact with suffering means in this sense, and what it might mean for us. None of us get through life without suffering. It's not a possibility. Some of us seem to suffer more than others, but we all suffer in some way or other. So symbolically, this suffering in the mythology of the Buddha is encapsulated in these three of the four sights. He realizes that he's subject to illness, old age and death. He has this realization. And I would suggest he also realizes that everybody else is subject to this. Yeah? Now there's nothing extraordinary about this. This is something that happens to us all at some point, probably quite early on in our lives. We realize we're going to die. Maybe it's not until we're quite a bit older that we realize how fragile things like our health are, how easily lost that is. But anyway, we all have this presented to us. We can't go through life without knowing suffering. Not possible. But once we've had that experience, we have a kind of choice. I don't know if we should call it a choice, but as whether we call it a choice or not, we can react in different ways. And the vast majority of us turn away from it in some way or other. And we turn away from it in all sorts of ways. We basically do it, as a sort of self-induced amnesia. Yeah? We just don't quite take it on. We know it's there. We have some experience of it, but somehow we manage to then turn away from it and go on with our normal lives. Go on as if these things don't exist. Or go on as if they're not going to get us somehow. Yeah. And there's all sorts of so many different ways that we turn away from this experience. I'm not going to enumerate them now, but most commonly we get lost in what we could call a mundane. You know, we get lost in life. We get lost in our job, or our relationships, our house, our clothes. We just get lost somewhere. We just don't quite face it. We don't quite confront it. And the difference, we're told, with Prince Siddhartha is that it hit him so deeply, it went in so deeply, penetrated him so deeply that that wasn't an option for him. He couldn't go back to his old life. He couldn't just go back to his wife and child and pretend that he hadn't had this profound experience of suffering. It wasn't even directly his suffering, which is quite interesting, which maybe implies from a very early time in his life. He had a lot, in fact we get this through stories of when he's a boy. He seems to have a very strong empathy with other people. So he's not directly experienced old age, sickness or death. But having seen it as a fact of the world, he's not able then to go back to his normal life. So he has a decision to make. What's he going to do with his life? We get this picture of him just becoming unsettled, deeply unsettled, unable just to pretend he hasn't had this realization. So this is the realization of suffering, yeah? And unless we individually take it on fully, which is not to say that's all life is, Buddhism never says that, but unless we take it on fully, really we're going to, even if we're practicing as Buddhists, to some extent we've always got a foot in the other camp, as it were. We've never really gone for refuge or committed ourselves, yeah, until we've really taken on this suffering, this idea of suffering. Yeah. Anyway, the Buddha didn't have the option, didn't feel he had the option to ignore it. And this begins the phase of his life we might call his quest. Yeah. So this part of his life rather resonates with the sort of heroic quest. He sets off, he leaves everything behind. You all know the story, I'm sure. He leaves it behind and he goes on the quest, yeah. And I'm not going to say too much about the quest. It takes many years. He starts off with two of the most renowned teachers in that part of India at the time. That part of northern India at the time was evidently a hotbed of spiritual activity. Yeah, there was lots and lots of different... I should have mentioned the fourth sight, shouldn't I? Which gives him the clue, which is relevant here. So he has the three sights of old age, sickness and death, and he has this fourth sight of a mendicant, a wanderer, a shramana. There's a has been estimated that up to a third of the male population at that point in that part of India were actually living this homeless life, just wandering around, begging, living a very simple, stripped-down life, looking for truth, looking for enlightenment. And he sees one of these people, and it seems to him, and he's supposed to see this from the palace, a window of the palace, out of the window of the palace, he sees this person wandering, and it seems to him that this person has a certain composure, has a certain ease, is at home in his body and in the world. He gets this impression, he gets this sense, and he thinks, oh, well, maybe this is something I can try. Maybe this is something that will bring some answers to this problem of suffering. So anyway, he sets out on his own quest. We're told he goes with two of the most renowned teachers of the day, and we're told that he achieves very high spiritual attainment with these people. Technically, we're told that he achieves both the dhyanas of form and the formless dhyanas. And for whatever reason, he's not satisfied with this experience. He doesn't say, oh, I've cracked it here. So he leaves these teachers. So it's this quest, really, we can see it, there's the initial going forth from the family life, and then there's a whole sequence of going forth after that. So the quest itself is always, if you like, the whole of the quest is like a going forth, not just the initial leaving of his life. If we put ourselves in his position, which is quite, maybe quite hard to do, but if we imagine we get involved with a spiritual group, it's what the Buddha did. He went to a teacher, he got involved with a spiritual group. After a fairly short time, a couple of years maybe, I don't know, I can't remember how long it is, after a fairly short time, he's recognized by the head of that group, who himself is a famous teacher, in that part of India, is recognized by the head of that group as not only that person's equal, but having attained spiritually higher, and he's offered the leadership of that group. And if we imagine ourselves in that position, it's probably quite hard to, isn't it? But if you did imagine yourself in that position, it's quite a seductive thing, yeah? It's quite seductive, perhaps. But for the Buddha, or the Buddha-to-be, he just says, well, thank you very much, but I don't feel that even though I've attained these higher spiritual experiences, I don't feel that they've sorted out my experience in the world, of being in the world, of how to be in the world. And so anyway, he goes from these groups. He goes from these teachers, he leaves them. And the next thing he tries out is living as an ascetic. So this is a very strong current within the Indian tradition. Not only the Indian tradition, of course we find it in the Christian tradition, probably most spiritual traditions, this idea of leading a life based in some sort of self-mortification of the flesh. And we've got some basic dualism going on here. Some idea, and I'm not even going to attempt to explain it really, so I've never found much resonance with it personally, but there's some idea that if we overcome the body, some release, the spiritual part of us can be released, by the overcoming of our bodily desires. So it's this sort of quite a dualistic, it's based in quite a strong dualism, a split between what we could call body and spirit, Yeah. Or world, in sort of other worlds, you know, some sort of like this idea of we can be liberated in a very literal way, kind of leave this earthly body somehow, liberate the spirit from the body. So he's involved in this. He's involved with this with a small group of fellow ascetics living in the forest. And he does this, I think it's for 6 or 7 years. He does this for a long time, so it's quite a long time to be living in this way, yeah? And we're told he becomes very renowned. So these people, it's still the case to some extent in India, I think, that these people are often quite revered, yeah? Often seen by the population. Often seen by the people as very holy men, yeah, or women. And we're told that he does this to such an extreme, such a degree, that he becomes very famous as an ascetic, and he's a leader of this little ascetic band. He naturally seems to attract other people around him. He's obviously got that sort of personality going on. Other people joining and practicing with him, looking up to him. And then we get this day when he goes to wash in the river, and he's nearly dragged away by the current. He's so weak and enfeebled that just in the act of washing he nearly dies, yeah. Act of washing the river, and then we're told he has this realization. He has this thought, well, I nearly died there, I could have just died, and I haven't really got anywhere. So he has this realization that this ascetic way of life hasn't got him anywhere. And he goes back, and I've always found this quite a sort of moving part of the Buddha to be's life. He goes back to this band of fellow ascetics and he says to them, look, this isn't working, this is no good. We're not getting anywhere doing this. And we're told that he's met with derision. They feel that he's gone soft, that he's deserting them. And he leaves them. And again, what this, coming back to the sort of original idea that this is a human being that has repeatedly and consistently tried to live from his own experience. He's had this experience, he's tried this thing out very fully, and based on his own experience he's decided that it doesn't work, it's no good, even though it's a very recognized practice at the time. Even though he's greatly honoured for doing this practice, even though he's got this small band of followers that are looking for him for leadership, all these things, he decides that actually what he's doing isn't consistent with what he's looking for, and he leaves again. So it's at least a third going forth. He goes forth yet again. And I wonder, I suppose I find this sort of poignant and important because I wonder in our own lives that I think sometimes we get to a point in our life where we see something fairly clearly. We see the way we're living is not really resonating with what has real depth in us. Yeah, we get to that point. And we do something about it, and we sort of feel good about that. We do something about it. We leave our job, or whatever it is. We do something, we make a move towards something more authentic and genuine in us. And then, after a couple of years, we find ourselves sort of back in some sort of something routine, something that we know isn't really challenging us. And the next time, perhaps, it's hard, or we don't quite make it. We've kind of lost. I suppose this is why I started with this idea of faith. I don't know where the Buddha got it from, or the Buddha to be got it from, but he sort of had some kind of faith going on. He had some sort of confidence. I don't know that he necessarily, and this is a way, this is partly why I invoked Socrates early on, because I don't know if Siddhartha necessarily thought, I'm going to crack this, I am going to, what we call get enlightened now, whatever that means, but I don't know if he necessarily knew that. But what I think he did know very deeply, and I think what we can sort of know, and we intuitively know, that unless we're living our life from that depth, it's an unsatisfactory life. It's not quite right. We're not quite fulfilling ourselves as human beings. And perhaps we never end up like the Buddha does, getting enlightened or whatever the equivalent is for us. But in a way, I don't know that that matters. I don't know that that's really that important. I think what's important is that you and I and we have this sense that we're living our life kind of fully. We're being as fully human and engaged with our life as possible. And it seems to me the Buddha's quest is remarkable in that he just goes forth again and again, even though firstly it's against the wishes and desires of his family, his clan, his people. Then it's against the sort of conventional spirituality of the time, which was telling him, look, you've achieved what there is to achieve. And he just thought, well, no, this isn't right. And then, again, from this ascetic band of brothers, which will look to him for leadership. You know. Again, he just goes forth. So he makes this third or fourth going forth again. Okay, so we come, and it's this final going forth, in a way, from the life of asceticism. And then we enter into this very interesting period leading up to the Enlightenment. And I've talked about this in the past, and I'm not going to say too much about it tonight. I've suggested in the past that we can interpret this as a kind of emergence of a kind of receptive mode in him, a sort of, sometimes you can put it, perhaps it's the re-emergence of the feminine into his life, because what comes directly or pretty much after this experience of nearly drowning is that he decides to take nourishment once again, so he's practically starving, he's practically dead on his feet. And we're told that he takes nourishment from a passing or a cow herder, goat herder, I don't know, lady that looks after cows, a cow looker after, anyway. And she gives him, you know, some sort of milk, rice. Anyway, he takes nourishment, and we can see this literally. It might be literally true. The guy's starving, he needs to take nourishment. But as with the whole of the Buddha's life, it occupies this strange liminal place between myth and reality. Yeah? I don't want to make that, I'm not positing that as a dualism, I'm positing it as a kind of, all our lives are led on this level, aren't they? Both as a sort of actuality of life in a mundane sense, and it's more sort of mythological, this mythic archetypal life that we all lead. We all lead life like that, yeah. And so when the story of the Buddha comes down to us, both the kind of archetypal or mythological is revealed as well as the literal. So literally he takes nourishment, and you can make of it what you like on an archetypal level. That he's, for the first time in many years actually, there's this female presence, this feminine presence. He's been practicing with these hardcore guys in a forest for like the last 7 years. So for the first time in a long time, this feminine figure comes back into his life. Anyway, he also has this very important, you could say pivotal, memory comes, which I'm sure all of you know. It's this, what's come down to us as the rose apple experience. And this is just the experience of him watching his father plough a field and him going into some sort of spontaneous sense of contentment or ease, hard to say, meditative state. Yeah. So he has this memory come back to him, and this gives him some clue. He thinks, oh, okay, so maybe that's the way is to meditate. So, the story after this is a very well-known story. So he finds his way, he recovers his health to some degree, and at some point he decides to sit under this Bodhi tree, and meditate. That's what he does. And then we get this very strong story of the attack of Mara. So Mara is this demonic figure, I don't know. So it's a very strong story of Mara's attack on the Buddha to be. He's on the brink of enlightenment here. And we're told he just sits in perfect peace, tranquility, equanimity as this attack goes on. And it's precisely this. I don't know what we make of this from a traditional Buddhist point of view. It's portrayed as these demonic figures outside attacking him, hurling stones, rocks, all sorts of weapons at him. And he just sort of sits there, and his weapons are meant to touch his aura and turn into blossom and just fall harmlessly around him. And he's also meant to send out a feeling of love, compassion to these demonic forces which are ranged against him. Yeah. Very moving idea. He just extends out this thought of unconditional love to this army, Mara's army. So It's not really necessary for me, I don't think, to draw a psychological equivalent of what's going on here. We can all do it. I think it gives us a very, very important, vital clue to what the Enlightenment meant. So this is we're still saying it's leading up to the Enlightenment, but in fact it's part of the process of what become known as the Enlightenment. Yeah. So he has this experience of being able to sit with, I think this is one way of putting it, in this symbolic terms, he's sitting with being attacked by demonic forces. And anybody that's done any meditation will be to some extent familiar with this. Yeah. Sitting with, this learning to be able to sit with our experience, however it is, yeah. And rather than react with anger or craving, of course, he's also subject to that. We won't go into that, but he's also in a way attacked with craving. We won't bother with that. So he learns to sit with both aversion and craving. He learns that if he sits with it, and if he regards it with kindness, it's harmless to him. Yeah. It's harmless to him. So this is a very important insight. It's really tantamount to his enlightenment, really. It's all part of the same thing. And if we remember why he's gone forth in order to try and find some resolution to suffering, we can see that it's in this experience that really he first starts to understand that resolution, yeah? This possibility of just sitting with, not turning away, but just sitting with, allowing things. A very powerful and beautiful image, these weapons, these things that would normally greatly hurt him, yeah, cause great pain, just falling harmlessly down as blossoms, flower blossoms around him, yeah. It's a very strong image. I think it would be useful, I mean, for us all to sort of remember when we're meditating, yeah, that is, according to Buddhism, a possibility for Siddhartha, and it's a possibility for us to learn that it's possible to sit and allow things to fall around us harmlessly in that way. Yeah. We don't have to do anything about them, as it were. We just have to, I'm going to say, stand our ground, sit our ground, yeah. It's always been a very strong image for me, this idea, I mentioned it today, this idea that he sits on the Vajrasana, he sits on the diamond throne, he sits on the place where the universe first coalesced. This is what's said. It says that the universe is a gaseous mass. And it begins to sort of coalesce, begins to harden. And at that first point becomes the Vajrasana, the diamond throne, which all Buddhas, past, present and future, all gain enlightenment at the same spot. And I don't know why, I've always found that a very strong image, a very useful image to have. Because every time we sit down, we have that possibility. When we sit down with real intent, the intent to be compassionately present, whenever we have that intent, you could say we occupy our ground, we occupy our place in the world, we step into our place in the world, we could say this, yeah. Obviously, we don't take it as a geographical location. We take it, in a way, as a psychic location. It's a place in our psyche that we can step into and be ourselves, yeah? Be fully ourselves. So this is the image of him. This is what he's done. He's sat down in his place in the universe. He's taken his place. And when we take our place, in a way, we're always central in the sense that we're fully connected with the world. We're not central in the sense that we're more important than the world. We're central in the sense that we're in it. We're in the middle of it. We're in the very center of life. When we're fully present, we're present in life. And this is this image of him sitting on this diamond throne. Anyway, he gets enlightened. I'm not going to say too much about enlightenment, I haven't got time, but I wanted to say something about this, just fairly briefly perhaps, just something about what happens after his enlightenment. After his enlightenment, we're told that he thinks, well, after his enlightenment, first off, he spends quite a lot of time in the same area, sitting under various trees, kind of absorbing the experience. He's had this very profound experience of understanding how things arise and pass away. He's had this very deep experience of what conditions him, what conditions his mental states, how he is fully responsible for his mental states, how it is possible for him to take full responsibility for himself. I'm always, when I think of this, I'm always reminded again of a different lot of Greeks, the Stoics, you know. They're very similar. They have this idea, there's only one thing we really have control over, and that's what they call our conscience. This is what we're really responsible for in the world. We can't really be responsible for anything else. We don't have control over the world. We don't have control of when we're going to die. We don't have control of what other people are going to do. As much as we might like to have this control, we just don't have it. What we do have is the choice of whether we act from good conscience, as it were. It's very similar, really, to what the Buddha's saying. You do have the choice about how you act. You have a choice about acting in a loving, open, aware way. That's your choice. You do have that. Not easy, but you have it. Anyway, he's had whatever this enlightenment experience is. There's more to it than what I've said, but we'll have to move on. He's had this experience. And he thinks, okay, I've had this experience. But there's no way I can transmit this experience to other people. Perhaps it's just too deeply personal in a way, I don't know. Anyway, he has this thought, I can't. And then we're told he has this vision, and it's this vision I just wanted to say a few words about. And again, it's an image, nearly all of us heard this before. He has this vision of this, all beings as a sort of vast field of lotuses. If you go to Kew Gardens, you see them. They have a very nice lotus house. They know a little house. Mm-hmm. And you see they start under the water. They, in fact, start in the mud, don't they? This is that traditionally put. They grow out of the mud. And then they slowly, when they come into full flower, the flower is completely above the water. It's just above the water. So they grow out of the mud into the light. And he has this vision of this field of lotuses in all their various stages of growth, from still being, I suppose, seeds in the mud, to being fully open flowers. You know. And it's this vision, we're told, that makes him think, oh yeah, I can teach, I can communicate this, because some people are very near to this experience themselves. They just need a little bit of how Socrates would put it, they just need a midwife. Yeah? They just need someone to give them confidence, to really realise what's already there. In a way, it's always there, isn't it, in our experience. I think the fact that we're all here tonight, the fact that you come, testifies to the fact that it's there somewhere in your experience. What the Buddha is trying to convey to us is already there, potentially, in our experience. We know when we step towards it, I think, and we know when we step away from it. We kind of know this intuitively, I believe. If we didn't know this, I don't think any sort of spiritual life was possible. We feel it. Maybe we don't think it. We have all sorts of ways of rationalising what we do, but we feel it in our bones somewhere, don't we? We feel it in our body, in our bones, in what I might call soul, when we turn away from our own lives. Yeah, we feel it. Anyway, he has this vision, and when I was thinking of this vision, this Rumi poem came to mind, because it has a very sort of similar image. I don't know if it is a similar image, where he says, out beyond ideas of right doing and wrong doing, there is a field. I will meet you there. Out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and right-doing, there is a field, I will meet you there. When the soul lays down in that grass. The world is too full to speak of. Ideas, language, even the notion, one another, no longer makes any sense. So there's something about that line in that poem that reminds me of his vision, and it is this line, there is a field. There's some sort of openness that we have a choice of stepping into. And I think we could see this as quite equivalent to this vision that the Buddha had. He saw that people had this choice with the right sort of support, perhaps, with what we're now, what came to be known as Sangha, with the right sort of support and care for one another, we can perhaps meet each other in this field, yeah. Whatever that might mean to you. Anyway, I'm speaking a lot longer than I wanted to. So, I just wanted, just leave that there, you can just make of that what you like. I just wanted to invoke one last thing, really. And I wanted to invoke the Buddha as an old man. Because for some reason I find the image of the Buddha as an old man extremely moving. So you had this guy that had this enlightenment experience. And then for the next 40 years, he's had this profound experience, yeah? And for the next 40 years, he lives as a wandering mendicant. He lives walking from village to village, teaching. He lives with a couple of robes in a bowl. Every day he goes out and he begs door to door for his food. Every day of his life, from his enlightenment to his death, he goes out and he begs. He's probably wearing rags. I don't know, I find this a very moving thing, this guy for 40 years wandering around India, just talking to people, just engaging with people, just trying to help people to realise what's deepest in them, to try and allow people to bloom in a way, to flourish in a way that he has, allow people to lead a good life, which he exemplified, you know, this life of meaning. I suppose in the end, you know, what I think the Buddha offers to us is a life of meaning, a meaningful life, which isn't going to take exactly the same form as his. But as an archetypal life, it opens the possibility of it for us. It opens the possibility that we could lead a life like that, yeah. A life which is, as shown by after his enlightenment, a life which is dominated by this compassion, yeah. So when he sees this field of lotuses, what arises in him? And what this is the point where he becomes a sage, I think. It's often said, sage is quite an important figure in Western philosophy, and it's been talked about, the sage has been talked about as someone who always has an eye on the world, as a sense. So someone who's made this basic transition from egocentric to altruistic. They've made this basis, so they always bear in mind the world. It's quite an interesting idea. They always bear in mind the world. They're always aware of the world. And this, according to some, is the defining characteristics of being a sage. They always bear in mind the world. So they're never completely sunk into themselves in the way that we so often are. They're always aware that they're part of the world. So I think for me, more than anything, the Buddha offers this model of someone who became deeply part of the world. Yeah, became a sage in this sense. Yeah. Okay, I think maybe I'll just leave it there. Maybe I'll just leave it there.